This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you've been watching The Apprentice on TV, you know that women are competing against men for a job with Donald Trump, and the women are winning. And if a new study released by Catalyst, a research group that focuses on women in business, is correct, companies with more women in top management are winning, too. They outperform their less diverse competitors. So how come relatively few women land the top jobs? It's not the size of the talent pool. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that women make up 49.7% of the workforce. The National Center for Education Statistics say that women now comprise 49% of undergraduate business programs and 41% of MBA programs. Some say that progress is blocked by a persistent glass ceiling. Others say that sexism is just part of the reason. Faced with the unrelenting demands of corporate competition, many women opt out in favor of a more balanced life. Later in the program, we'll look at the women who would be first lady and our expectations of a candidate's wife. But first, why do so few women make it to the top? If you're a woman, is being a CEO a goal for you? How much of your life are you willing to devote to the job, and do the rules of this game need to be changed? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Linda Tischler. She's a senior writer for Fast Company magazine. She wrote the article, Where Are the Women, in Fast Company's February issue, and she's with us from our bureau in New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Neil.
So why don't we begin with that glass ceiling? How much of a factor is it still?
I think it still is somewhat of a problem, although I think it's significantly less than it has been in the last 20 years. Certainly the women now are educated and they have experience, and by all rights they're as capable as the guys, as the Trump women would show you to do the job.
And your article is based on the premise that, 35 years after the explosion of the women's movement in this country, there ought to be more women in top jobs in corporations. How come?
Well, we were curious about that because all the evidence would point to the fact that there should be more women in these top positions, and we couldn't quite figure out the rationale for it. We happened upon a couple studies, one in London from the London School of Economics, another one out of Stanford, that gave us reason to think a little bit differently about this question. Both of them seem to point to another factor that may be at play here, and it's one I like to think of as a combination of values and control. Partly, I think what you're seeing is that, you know, women can do almost anything as long as they can manage to have some control over their lives. That is, you know, they can manage to balance, you know, family, work, all kinds of demands, travel, as long as they can plan for it. The problem is that the really top jobs are such that you really have to be on call 24/7. And the route to those jobs typically means you have to sign up for the kinds of positions in the organization that were leave you open to unplanned kinds of work. You know, the client crisis, the unplanned travel, the need to relocate, the need to be really on call whenever the company needs you, and to prioritize the company over your own life. And I think from what we've seen in these studies, women are less willing to do that than their male counterparts.
So when the crisis erupts over the school play or the client crisis, women, whether they do or not, would prefer to go to the school play.
Well, I think, you know, that's increasingly we're seeing guys making the same value judgments, but I think it's been tougher for women in the past and probably still now to make those decisions over and over again. Certainly, you know, women are willing to do that whenever the need arises, but to really make that sort of a long-term strategy in your life, I think is much more difficult for a woman.
You describe it the kind of competition as corporations try to select out those few who will be utterly dedicated to the job. You describe a sort of, you know, hazing ritual when people first join a big company or law firm.
You see it not just in corporate America, where, you know, Americans now are like the work more hours than any other people in the industrialized world. And I mean by a huge, huge fraction, like, you know, 100 hours more per year than the British, 250 hours more per year than the British, 500 more than the Germans, and it's just increasing. So the American workplace is really a pretty hostile environment to begin with. Similarly, at top law firms, and as we've seen with doctors, you know, the hazing rituals that select out the elite few are pretty draconian. And, you know, you really need to want that position to be able to be willing to put up with that.
But your article documents the case of at least several women who you talked to who went through that hazing process, who went up the corporate ladder and then later decided, hey, maybe this isn't worth it.
Well, I was really careful because I didn't want this just to be framed as, you know, a mother's problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I really tried to find people who either had really great support systems so that essentially they were at parity with guys. I mean, you know, all of the, you know, lots of women have written to me and said, you know, the guys can do this because they have women at home taking care of everything. And certainly I think there's a lot of merit in that argument. But in choosing examples to illustrate this story, I really tried to find people who didn't sort of fall into that category. And the women I chose either had really great support systems at home. One had a husband who was an artist who essentially served the role of, you know, a stay-at-home dad and was there so that she could work, you know, really crazy hours at a Wall Street firm. Brenda Barnes, who was CEO of PepsiCo North America, had, you know, fabulous support systems, you know, live-in help. A supportive husband. Mary Lou Quinlan had no children at all. And so there were lots of women in there who were essentially in the same position as a guy at the same level. And at some point in their careers, they sort of looked around and said, you know, is this job really worth, you know, the amount of effort, the pain that I am experiencing in doing this job, whether it means, you know, lack of sleep, lack of friends, inability to see my family, inability to read a book. I mean, you saw Barbara Walters step down and say, you know, I don't know how many years it's been since I could read a trashy novel. All those things finally outweighed their desire for that top position. Now, I want to be clear that these are not women who then, you know, dropped out to devote themselves to, you know, their inner tennis lady or their children's, you know, preschool bazaar or something like that. These
continued to work.
Yeah, right. No. I mean, these were serious women who wanted to continue working. They just didn't want to have to make work the be-all and end-all of their lives.
Now, I guess that raises a couple of different questions, one of which is, in that kind of competition, is it possible for women to compete with men? Clearly, at least as you're measuring it, they're not. They're choosing not to in some respects. And secondly, is that because men have set up the rules in such a way as that it favors them?
Well, I do think that the rules have been set up in a way that presumes a full bore support staff at home, so that you can do whatever it needs you need to do to just be, you know, the company person all the time. Obviously, we see a lot of women who are doing this. I mean, I don't want to shortchange the Carly Fiorinas, the Andrea Youngs, the really great women in corporate America, and in the Senate and in law firms and everywhere else. There are plenty of women who are doing this. It's just that in the aggregate, when you're looking at sort of the big numbers across the board, fewer women are willing to make these kinds of choices in their lives than the guys. And I do think you are seeing among younger men, certainly in the business schools now, we're getting anecdotal evidence from Wharton and Harvard and Stanford saying that the young guys coming out of MBA programs are also asking companies up front what their work-life balance situation is as a qualifier for whether they want a job or not. So, you know, the men are getting onto this too. It's just the women have been a little further ahead on this particular issue.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN at NPR.org. We're speaking with Linda Tischler of Fast Company magazine. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Tanya, and Tanya's with us from Santa Cruz, California.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share my experience because I personally have lived through this dilemma of how to have a challenging, intellectually stimulating career, but also balance, you know, personal and family issues. And I joined HP back in the 90s and, you know, with an MBA and was really on a good track towards leadership, well-respected by various business unit managers. But fundamentally, I kind of came to the realization that if I wanted to have any kind of balance, any kind of life and create a family, I couldn't stay on that track. And so ultimately, I left 2 years ago and started my own business. In fact, I completely changed and went over to the food industry. But, you know, even though I make far less than I did when I was with HP, I have emotional satisfaction. I have work-life balance. I live 10 minutes from home. You know, my husband and I are trying to start a family. All of that, I had to leave the company in order to make that possible. And when I left, what was interesting was the leaders around me, the managers around me, could not understand my decision. And I had worked with them to try to, you know, either cut back hours or do some telecommuting and resolve this and have some balance. And when I left, they just flat out couldn't understand why someone would choose to leave a high-paying position in order to, you know, do something for a lot less money just for the sake of family.
Well, Linda Tischler, this story sounds familiar from your article.
Well, could I jump in here for just a second, because it's interesting what your caller just described, because what we're seeing, and this came up over and over again in my reporting of this story, was that women are dropping out often to form their own businesses. In fact, women are starting businesses at twice the rate of men. The Center for Women's Business Research said that there's now, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 6.2 million women-owned businesses. You know, I think this is a strategy that's being employed more and more where, you know, women just can't tolerate the rules of corporate America anymore, but still have a lot of ambition, a lot of drive, a lot of smarts, and they want to, you know, put them towards something that they can control better, and often that's their own business.
And is that the way in which what we're talking about now is different from what we talked about several years ago, the old mommy track?
Yeah, I think it's not a mommy track. I think these women are empowered. They just don't want to play the same games. And, you know, it's not that they want to cut back to 15 hours a week. You know, they really want to keep working. Although there are, you know, a certain percentage, obviously, who are dropping out during those sort of hardcore childbearing years. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it will be interesting to see when they decide to re-enter the workforce how welcoming companies will be. I do think that as we're living longer, you're going to see a resurgence in women coming back in sort of a two-tier kind of strategy. In fact, we did talk to some women who wrote a book in Silicon Valley about this exact phenomenon. There are a lot of women who are heads of tech companies in the Valley who essentially, you know, had children early, did their child raising, you know, when they were in their 20s, and then, you know, got the kids launched and said, okay, it's my turn. I'm going out there and I'm going to burn up the track. So that could be a phenomenon that we'll continue to see.
Tanya, I wonder, was there a moment at Hewlett-Packard which you said, you know, that's just enough?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I had gone on a vacation with my husband and a couple other friends, and I literally was so stressed from my job that even though I was on vacation for a week, you know, in Alaska, you know, kind of as far away as you can possibly get from Silicon Valley, you know, I couldn't relax, and I was just a basket case. And so my friends literally had like a little intervention with me where they sat down and they said, hey, you're not you anymore, and we're worried about you. And it was really a wake-up call for me. And it took me a while to kind of come to the conclusion that what I needed to do was leave and kind of forge my own path. But I definitely had that moment of clarity. I'd like to make one other comment, which is the issue of...
If you could be very quick, please.
Yes. I'm very conscious of the fact, having made this decision, I'm now in a lower economic bracket than I was before. And what will that mean for me down the road? Certainly women already suffer from economic inequality, especially going into retirement. And I'll be you know, kind of concerned with how this trend will play out in terms of the disparity between men and women as they age.
Tanya, good luck to you and your new company.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing why there are still so few women at the top of America's corporate ladders. Our guest is Linda Tischler, a senior writer for Fast Company magazine. Is it the glass ceiling, or are women themselves opting out of the game? And if so, why? Join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN@npr.org. And joining us now is Warren Farrell. He's author of The Myth of Male Power. He says it's not just women who don't like the rules of the game. Men don't like it either. And he joins us now from his office in San Diego, California. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
When you say men don't like it either, I assume you're talking about the monomania that's required to make it to the top of that corporate competition.
Yeah, men basically have defined power in a way that really is the opposite of power. Men have, if I were to basically summarize men's definition of power, it would be basically that men have defined power as learning to feel obligated to earn money that somebody else spends while they die sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and women have been far more advanced than men. They've so when I've done the last year, I spent looking at the what men and women do in the workplace that differs from each other, and there's actually 25 measurable differences between what men and women do in the workplace. And if I were to summarize all those differences, all the men's differences, like hazardous jobs and things like that, tend to lead the men to earning more money. But all the women's differences differentiate based on how do I have a more balanced life, what stage of my life am I at, what goals do I have, have I looked inside of myself and decided whether they're my goals or are they my parents' goals or my goals of approval?
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, it's like the Tanya moment that, if you will, that we just heard Tanya from Santa Cruz talk about, and everything that Linda Titchler has been saying. There's been women are saying they get to be in their 30s or so, and they haven't gotten married or had children, and they say, "Do I want to have children?" The mommy track is very viable, and that's a part of the issue, but it's not the whole thing. It's women who own businesses. Women-owned businesses earn about 31% of what men-owned businesses earn because the women who run those women-owned businesses are saying, "I want a life that is I want to work out of my home. I want to have children. I want to spend time with my children out of my home." My own wife raised two children while working out of home. She runs her own business, but she would have been making more money mm-hmm. had she not been trying to be a good mom and also to be a and also to run her business. So it is like Linda is saying, it's about a value choice that women have, and women's values are basically saying, "I want my top priority to be, let me have a balanced life." And men have not had the power to have a balanced life. Men are in 2004, where women were at in 1954. They were, women before the women's movement didn't question, we followed a program, and women followed a program and men followed a program, and the women's movement helped women question that program. And as a result, when a woman, I remember being in, when I lived in New York, I was with around a kitchen table and a dinner table, and we were having the four of us, and there was a woman that was extremely powerful in New York City, and she said, "I have a surprise." And didn't take us too long to guess that she said that she was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had the next 2 hours of conversation were spent about whether she should be full-time involved with her career, full-time involved with the children, or some combination of both. But none of us, until I sort of confronted it about an hour and a half later, said, "Wait a minute, why aren't we having the same discussion with the husband here? Why are we not talking about him working full-time, him working, being full-time involved with the children, or him doing some combination of both?" And so we have, and yet when the Harris Poll recently did a study of women and men in their 20s and asked men and women both, if you had to give up money for more time with your family, what would you like to do? And 73% of the men said, I would give up money for more time with my family.
Well, Linda Titchler, let's bring you back into the conversation. Is this
sure.
It must be curious to hear that men don't have the power, but nevertheless, if that's the feeling amongst men and women, can't the rules be changed?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and a lot of corporations are wrestling with that. The problem, as Catherine Hakeem, the sociologist at the London School of Economics, pointed out, is that if you allow, for example, family leave policies for some workers and not for others, you're creating a two-tiered system that's going to come back and haunt you. I think
as soon as anybody takes it to court, it will. Yes,
exactly. So you know you have to be real careful about those things. However, you know, obviously, I think a lot of guys are going to say, you know, we'd like some balance in our lives too, and what are you going to do to accommodate us? Unfortunately, you know, there's a recent study of 101 HR professionals who said that, you know, 75% of them said their companies had work-life balance programs. 38% said that people were frowned upon if they used them, and 16% said employees feared being penalized for using them. So, you know, you can set up these programs. Whether people feel comfortable in using them is a real question in a very competitive work life. Whether you're being pegged as a loser, particularly if you're a guy, if you take paternity leave or other kinds of programs like that, you know, that you may be slotting yourself straight off the fast track if you're audacious enough to take part in those things. The other problem is that, you know, the really top jobs don't lend themselves to that kind of balance. I mean, as Haycom said to me, you can't be a part-time prime minister, you can't be a part-time president, you can't be a part-time CEO. You know, those jobs really require that you just be there full bore.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Doug, who's with us from Winnebago, Minnesota.
Hi, Neil. Great show.
Thank you.
I kind of lived my professional career from the inside out. Worked in electronics for years. And this is from the early 70s on into the early 90s. So the emergence of women in positions of engineers and then management, and watched how the corporate mentality, frankly, made life hell for these women, especially younger women. And I think the result, what you're seeing now in kind of an oblique way you're approaching, is women are more or less being forced out of these top positions if they want to live any kind of normal life.
Linda Tischler, is that right? Forced out?
Well, I don't know that they're forced out. I think, you know, it's a question of are they willing to do what it takes to stay in? You know, I wouldn't argue that there are probably some particularly male-oriented professions, engineering one of them, where the rules of the game are tougher than other fields. But, you know, I think it's tough all around, and I just think it's probably a little tougher for women.
I think there are a lot of, I mean, I think some of the rules can be changed in some areas. I think there are some jobs, like, you know, CEOs in major corporations, that we may wish to consider doing job sharing. There are other types of, the AMSA, the American Medical Student Association, is making its top priority this year, the pressuring of the medical profession to cut back the number of hours doctors work, and that innovation that pressure has occurred since more women have been going to medical school, and since women are saying, listen, we can be good doctors working 40 to 60 hours a week. We don't have to be working 90 to 100 hours a week, and it also helps compassion in dealing with people's everyday lives as a doctor. But yet there are some professions where you can't do that. You can also start encouraging. We can start encouraging women in the school system to marry men who are earning less, but who are good support systems, like the artist or like the man who wants to spend his life raising the children primarily and moving to the places where the woman moves to, so that the woman doesn't feel she has to give up a family.
Mr. Farrell, there's an issue here of, you know, it's not all these individuals making these choices in a vacuum. They're working at a company which is not necessarily interested in unilateral disarmament. They figure all their competitors are being just as ruthless about this as they are, and if they get soft on this, they're going to lose their edge.
Okay, so when I work with corporations, what I say to them, listen, what you're not valuing is what women bring to the workplace. A lot of women bring to the workplace, there are a lot of brilliant, talented women out there who want to work 35, 40 hours a week. Why are you assuming that a person who works 70 is going to be more productive for you in every position? Re-examine the positions. Some positions, a person who works 70 hours a week is going to be by far and away the most productive. But other positions, that's not true for. So we have to re-examine the positions and ask that question from anew. But the male mentality of saying that, you know, that you, you know, of working to 70, 80 hours a week and putting pressure on each other, that's what we need to question in the corporation.
Warren Farrell, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Warren Farrell is the author of The Myth of Male Power, and he joined us from his office in San Diego, California. Here's an email that we've gotten. The correspondent has asked that we not use her name. I'm graduating with a PhD in epidemiology in May. My advisor is very disappointed that I am not planning a career in academia, but I see him and so many other faculty members, both men and women. The most successful of them are either unmarried, divorced, or separated. I want to have a life outside my job. What about women in academia, teaching, publishing, and working in research all at the same time? Is that the same situation there, Linda Tischler?
Yeah, you know, I went out to Stanford to the Graduate School of Business when I was reporting this story and talked to, you know, several of the professors there, and they said the same thing, that in actual fact their lives were not dissimilar to those of their corporate colleagues, although obviously they have the advantage of the summer off, which is a little different. but they were working, they said that they couldn't let up either, that they were essentially at a place like Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Wharton. You know, the competition to stay on top, which, you know, the elite ranks in the academic world are similar to those staying in the elite ranks of the business world. And if they weren't, you know, going to the conferences, publishing the papers, teaching, consulting, doing all those things, that they wouldn't have their positions much longer either, and that the same rules really applied.
Joining us now is Margaret Heffernan. She's a woman who's had a lot of experience as the CEO of various technology companies. Right now, she's working on a book scheduled to come out this fall called The Naked Truth, A Modern Woman's Manifesto on Working and What Really Matters. And she's with us from San Francisco, California. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Neil.
If women are such a desirable asset, and we've been talking about that in companies, what should companies be doing to bring them, to keep them in the first place, and then bring them back if they leave?
Sure. There are a whole bunch of things, you know, and some of them are so obvious that people forget about them, which is that things like discrimination in pay has to be rooted out. It's still a systemic issue in many, many, many American and international corporations that women start at lower pay levels and they come out at lower pay levels. The message they get is that they are less valued, so it's sort of odd that anyone would expect them to stay. I think it's also true, as one of your speakers mentioned earlier, that it really doesn't matter how many family-friendly policies you have if you don't change the culture. And very, very few companies have really been willing to do what it takes to change their culture root and branch. I think it part of what companies have to do in analyzing performance, they need to look at the quality and effectiveness of work rather than just the quantity of hours and the amount of male bonding at in golf clubs and conferences and that sort of thing. They need to be very, very much more flexible in career patterns. Most corporations think you start at a low level, you work like crazy through your 30s, early 40s, and then you sort of level out. I think in the future what we'll see with women is that their careers look a lot more like an M, which is lots of acceleration, maybe some time out or some slower time if they want to have a family, and then lots more acceleration. We need to think much more flexibly and creatively about what career patterns can look like. I think the other thing is corporations often don't assume that women are ambitious. They don't ask them what they want, and they don't help them to get there. They still think that the female income is a secondary income, and they don't necessarily assume that women are as eager to get to the top as men are, and so they don't put support structures in place.
We're speaking with Margaret Heffernan and Linda Tischler. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line, and Sarah joins us on the phone from Redwood City, California.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I'm calling because I think I'm probably one of these women that's perfectly situated to climb the corporate ladder, as it were. I'm a senior attorney with a large technology company in California. My husband's a full-time stay-at-home dad. I have an 8-month baby. My company's bent over backwards, I think, to keep me. They are very flexible with me. I was promoted while I was on maternity leave. But I have to say, I think your guests are probably right that it's really a value choice for women. Even with all of these factors, I'm just not interested right now in gaining that top job. And the reason for that is that I want to go home and see my child.
Hmm. And is that a failure of your company, do you think?
It's not a failure of my company. I think they've been very interested in keeping me on. I think it's more just a personal choice, and I like to think that I'm a little bit ahead of the curve and having things be so clear for me in the way that I look at my life and the choices that I want for myself and my family.
Margaret Heffernan, you would suggest that maybe this is a time for someone like Sarah to be relatively fallow for a little while, then come back later.
It might be. It depends a lot on the kind of mother you are, because I was a CEO of two software companies when I was pregnant with my second child, and my first one was a toddler. And I did that for several reasons, one of which was my sister gave me a great piece of advice. She said, your children need you more as they get older. And I decided very deliberately that I was just going to work my backside off the first 5 years of their life, when I actually could get them very good child care and they could be very well looked after, so that then when they were older and they had much more complicated issues, you know, like ethics and values and friendships and so on, I could have more time with them. So I think, you know, the message that companies need to get is that there isn't a standard kind of template for what a female career looks like. And every woman has to figure that out for themselves, but they need corporations to look upon this as an asset to be nurtured rather than as a problem. And I think one of the issues that we see is that most companies assume that the male pattern is the normal one, and therefore anything female is kind of deviant.
And let me ask Linda Tischler about that. A lot of people you interviewed in your article, and we just have a little time left, but a lot of people said, look, it ain't going to change.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, though, that I thought of when Margaret was talking was I was sort of surprised to find that a number of the women I spoke to decided to scale back when their children were teenagers as opposed to whenever they were little. And I found that, having had teenagers myself, not surprising, given that it, you know, it's on some level, it's easier to hand off a toddler to somebody, a good, you know, caretaker who can read them stories and tuck them, than it is to deal with, you know, 13-year-olds who are just so needy and whose problems are so complex. And so it was interesting to me to find that pattern going on with a lot of these women.
Sarah, very briefly, it doesn't sound like you're all that interested in ducking back later or, well, whenever.
Well, no, I'm very interested, I guess, in ultimately doing what I can for my career. I'm very invested in my career. It's very fulfilling for me. It's just a matter of going that extra 10%, and that's not at the top of my list right now.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Sarah joined us from Redwood City, California. Thanks to our guests as well, Linda Tischler, a senior writer at Fast Company magazine. She joined us from her bureau in New York. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And Margaret Heffernan, we appreciate your time today as well.
Thank you very much.
Margaret Heffernan, former CEO of various technology companies. She's working on a book called The Naked Truth, A Modern Woman's Manifesto on Working and What It Really Means. It'll be out this fall. She joined us from San Francisco.